regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
Government regulations, which were created to protect
the regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Nathan Beacom. I'm the Assistant Director for RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. Today, we bring you a great discussion titled, Can Patents and Bayh-Dole Fuel Innovation in the Time of COVID-19? For our moderator today, we are pleased to have Adam Mossoff, who's Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. If our audience would like to learn more about all our speakers and their important work, you can visit regproject.org, where we have listed all of their bios. In a moment, I'll turn it over to Adam to get us started and moderate the conversation. After opening remarks and discussion, we'll go to audience Q&A, so please be thinking of questions you might like to ask our speakers. Thank you all for joining us. Adam, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Nathan, and it's a real delight to be speaking with this fantastic panel on this topic of patents and Bayh-Dole and the importance of biopharmaceutical innovation in the time of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, almost from the very beginning of the designation of COVID-19 as a pandemic in approximately February or March, policymakers and activists have been calling for the elimination of patent rights or treatments and even potentially a vaccine on the COVID-19 virus. Now, so this has raised a really interesting question, which is, are patents and patent licensing more generally, do these provide an essential and legal and economic mechanism for successful innovation in 21st century healthcare, or are they blockades to this type of research, development, and ultimately the providing of a cure or other types of treatments for patients in the healthcare market? We have as our panelists today three individuals who have a vast background and wealth of knowledge and experience in this field, and who will certainly provide much evidence and data to serve as a foundation for effective and evidence-based policymaking. I don't believe in giving long introductions. Everyone is certainly able to easily Google these individuals and find the long list of their accolades and achievements in their careers. So I will just quickly give their names. and their immediate institutional affiliations, and then we will shift into our event because that is why you wanted to hear them. So our first speaker will be Leslie Miller-Nicholson, who is Director of the Technology Licensing Office and Director Catalyst Office of Strategic Alliances and Technology Transfer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Oh, I'm sorry, Leslie. That title is very lengthy and rivals many other academic titles. Our second speaker will be Corey Salzberg, who is Vice President of Global Head and IP Affairs at Novartis. And our third speaker is Brian O'Shaughnessy, who is a partner at Dinsmore & Stahl and is past president of the Licensing Executive Society of the USA and Canada. So you do not want to hear me speak. You want to hear our panelists. So I will kick it off by asking some initial questions of our panelists, and then we will engage in some back-and-forth dialogue, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. So first, I'd like to start our event today by asking Leslie, you know, as scientists and researchers are racing to invent treatments and possibly even a vaccine for COVID-19, it's obvious, I believe, that research and development of these innovations is key. We're not going to get medical care, medical treatments, more tests, or even a vaccine if you don't have extensive research and development being deployed in this space. Could you describe a bit the role of scientists at universities in research and development, and perhaps even more importantly, how is this important work supported?
Certainly. Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to join everyone on this esteemed panel. To begin with, I'll give you just a brief overview answering that specific question, Adam, about how university research is funded. But then I'd also like to speak specifically about what we've seen in terms of what's going on in recent months with regard to research specifically at MIT, and in talking to colleagues, that pattern is across the world in many major European and US universities. So many of you, and the title of this talk is related to Bayh-Dole, know that a significant portion of research at U.S. universities is funded through the federal government, with a statistic at MIT of we have about $700 million worth of research going on the MIT campus alone. About 80% of that comes from the federal government in some form or other. At Lincoln Labs, it's about $1 billion, and obviously that is all coming through the federal government. So to begin with, understanding the obligations that flow through to us from federal funding, which are embodied in the Bayh-Dole Act, is that universities and small companies are allowed to own their own inventions, which is why we insist on taking title. That we have to give the government royalty-free rights back. They get the government license to use that, and they get to pass that on to their contractors. We are encouraged to partner with industry to translate research into products benefiting the public, and that's very specifically because we are not manufacturing entities. The ideas, the innovations are being created are so early stage that they need partners, whether industry, corporate partners, small companies, small medium enterprises, or startup companies. We really are the beginning of the pipeline. Also, an obligation is to give preference to small businesses to actually make those products, and more recently, even more so, to make sure that U.S. manufacturing is not just a priority, but it has to be done unless there is a good exception to that. And we also have an obligation to flow the money back to invest in more research, to reward inventors, and basically to support a cycle of invention time and time again. So kind of evergreening any revenue that might come in, recognizing that a large portion of the inventions that are created at universities are so early stage that we're actually creating new markets. Or, you know, the ideas have yet to be formed into what a market might be, which is why we rely so heavily on startup companies, venture capitalists and the like. So that's just a brief overview on that. What I would like to comment on, I think it's pertinent to this discussion, is that in looking at the 124 projects that have been picked up since the beginning of January, February, when this became apparent that universities were going to be key in finding some and solving problems related to COVID, 124 projects going on at MIT, 177 faculty involved, 34 departments. These are technologies and ideas that are building on the back of decades of research, new ideas being applied to the current problems of COVID, how to contain, how to treat, how to track, how to model dynamics, how to look at communities and keep communities safe. The range of departments involved is broad. It's not just patented IP, and the response from universities has been huge. So I just want to put in context the fact that one of the reasons that the patent system is so important is that many of these things that we're trying to deal with at the moment are building on decades and millions of dollars of research already started. And we do want to get it into the hands of the people that can develop it further and to give accessibility to as broad a population as possible. And we are used to that. We do that. We do that for humanitarian purposes. We've built it into many of the things that Autumn has done with its 9 points to consider. So it is at the essence of what universities are used to. We've just had to ramp this up in this desperate time.
Great. Well, thank you for that overview in great detail, especially what's happening at the level of universities and how they are translating very early upstage research into downstream products and services through venture capitalists and startups and other mechanisms. Corey, as I mentioned, Leslie just described the incredible work being done at universities. Could you describe how the biopharmaceutical sector has responded to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure, Adam, and thanks very much again for the opportunity. I'm really excited to be here joining this panel on the Federalist Society here. You know, Leslie mentioned building on the backs of what came before, so let me start with a little story about that. It's from Plutarch's Life of Antony, and there's a story where Cleopatra invites Mark Antony on a date to go fishing on the Nile, and as a Roman elite, Mark Antony was never taught to fish, so he ends up catching nothing, and he's embarrassed. So then Cleopatra invites him back for a second day of fishing, and this time he arranges for his men to dive down and to secretly attach some choice fish that had been previously caught to his hook under the water. And of course, then he's able to pull in fish after fish, and everyone's very impressed. So what's the point there? It's that, like Antony in this tale that I just mentioned, you know, we unfortunately are not equipped to just start reeling in safe and effective medicines and vaccines for this completely novel virus on day one. But thanks to the IP system, we too have some tricks up our sleeve. And kind of like, you know, Antony's men here in putting the fish in advance on the hook, the patent system, as Leslie also explained, has kind of helped us line up a vast array of different leads in advance over the last several decades. So the hunt for COVID treatments and vaccines is really not a blind fishing expedition. We've got millions of novel compounds in our libraries that are ready to test. We have a vast array of tools to help us quickly narrow them down to the best candidates, and we have a host of existing technologies that we have been able to repurpose that allow us to start tackling this virus at a very advanced stage, kind of midstream, all thanks to the patent system. And that's really exactly what we're doing, you know, on the industry side. Thanks to patents, in just a few short months, industry has initiated over 850 active clinical trials looking at COVID treatments. Many of these are in phase three, so that's kind of the tail end of the R&D process. And when there's over 100 preclinical vaccine studies going on. And now let me just give you some more specific examples from our own work at Novartis, because not because they're by any means, you know, the only or the most important, because there's so much work going on across the industry, but they are illustrative of the different kinds of approaches that industry is taking. So we've got two phase three clinical trials of two existing drugs that are currently patented and approved for other uses. One is a drug called Ilaris. It's canakinumab is the molecule. It's an interleukin-1 beta blocker that's currently used for periodic fever syndromes and juvenile arthritis, but it's looking to have promise in treating cytokine storm, which is the severe immune overreaction that the body is giving in extreme COVID cases. Another drug with also looking at cytokine storm, but a very different approach, is called Jakavi. It's an oral inhibitor of the JAK1 and JAK2 tyrosine kinases, and it's used right now to treat bone marrow cancer. But again, we're using that to look at its promise in treating cytokine storm and something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, which is also one of the big problems in COVID patients. And again, if it weren't for a robust patent system, these drugs simply wouldn't exist to test today as leads for COVID. Just one more I want to mention, because it's our newest example. We are not actually a vaccines company anymore. We used to have a vaccines division that we sold off to GSK a few years ago. But we have just in the last few weeks teamed up with Mass General and Mass Eye and Ear Hospital to work on what is a completely novel technological approach to vaccines. And it's based on one of our existing patented gene therapy platforms. Specifically, we're using we have a company called AveXis that has invented one of the first gene therapies really ever approved, and the first one for a rare genetic disorder called spinal muscular atrophy. So it's used right now to deliver a missing gene into the cells of patients with spinal muscular atrophy. And when it delivers that missing gene, the body's able to start acting more normally and creating the missing protein in gene therapy. We are now kind of working with Mass General and Mass Eye and Ear to repurpose that same vector. It's an adeno-associated virus, and we're using that as a vector to deliver a piece of the DNA from the COVID virus that actually codes for its spike protein. And the reason why this is really novel is because most of the vaccine approaches today are using regular adenoviruses, which may be very effective, and we certainly hope that they are. But one of the problems with adenoviruses is that they are something that already infects the human body. So there's some concern that in at least some of these, the body might end up attacking the delivery mechanism before it can do its job. But AAV, adeno-associated viruses, doesn't affect humans normally. So this will actually circumvent that problem if it's successful. And it's just another example of the patent system and a whole platform here giving us a tremendous technological head start in tackling this virus in a very different way. I just want to touch on one more point, a different role of IP, and then I'll stop and we can move on and address more of this later. But there's an unprecedented amount of collaboration, as Leslie already mentioned, going on right now to produce treatments and vaccines, even more than normal, public-private, private-private, private to university, and NGOs as well. So just some examples there. In addition to the partnership with Mass General and Mass Dianeer that I just mentioned, we are members of the Gates COVID-19 Therapeutics Accelerator Consortia, the COVID-19 Direct Partnership, which is organized by IMI in Europe with the European government, the Active Partnership here in the U.S., that's with NIH, FDA, CDC, and also the European Medicines Agency. And then we also have an interesting collaboration with the University of Berkeley focused on COVID, where we're working to develop, this is very early stage, but early antiviral compounds that will target a piece of the viral machinery that's shared by several known coronaviruses. So the idea is that this could work not only now, but in the event that either this virus mutates or we have future coronavirus pandemics, it'll be successful there. And far from being a barrier to collaboration, as some allege, and as you mentioned in your opening, IP is really proving to be instrumental in facilitating these types of collaborations. It's allowing us to identify the right partners with the right intellectual assets to collaborate with in each of these different consortia and partnerships. And it's also enabling us to actually contribute to the max by allaying concerns about the confidentiality of our existing assets, about prior obligations that we may have with regard to some of these assets. And it frees us up to open our compound libraries, to share our platform technology and our know-how without sacrificing our entire business model and our ability to continue to invest in the future pipeline. And the last thing it does is, to the extent there are developments that come out of these consortia that may have application well beyond COVID-19, you know, even if we, and we can talk about this later, but even if we're going to do things like voluntary licensing or product donations for COVID treatments, without IP, you wouldn't have the incentive to take what's gained from these consortia in terms of other IP that's associated with this and develop into different directions where it might be useful for other medical uses. So in short, as you can see, I mean, our response has been an unprecedented level of innovation and collaboration in record time, really all on account of and not in spite of the IP system.
Excellent. Thank you, Corey. And I believe this is the first time in a panel on biopharma patents that not only did we learn about patents as a platform in providing a technological head start in an unprecedented response to a pandemic, but we also learned a bit about Plutarch and Mark Antony and Cleopatra. So very impressive.
Happy to oblige.
Brian, you know, Corey has described, as I just mentioned, incredible response by the biopharmaceutical sector in terms of both scale and scope. Leslie has described incredible work being done at universities. You know, what has made all of this possible, and what is driving all of this? We've already heard a little bit on the role of patents as a platform. Maybe you can expand on some of these points?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Adam. And thanks also to the Federalist Society for putting this panel together. I'm delighted to be here with such esteemed colleagues, and I'm always impressed when somebody can sort of outdo you, Adam, with a little bit of legal history and bring in some perspective from the past. So thank you, Corey, for that. Adam, to answer your question, and I think to build upon what both Leslie and Corey said, is that the one thing that the patent system does for us that brings all of that together is that it facilitates an element of specialization. So we, through the patent system, we allow people to focus on the things that they are really, really good at and interested in doing and willing to take the risks to do. And in so doing, they can identify what those things are, and they can put a little bit of a legal fence around what they've done so that we can then facilitate the orderly conveyance of those rights and that entities can come together in a way that exploits their respective areas of specialization, and they can engage in an orderly exchange of those rights in a way that ensures that their investment will be worthwhile, that they may get an a meaningful return on their investment. They can more effectively calculate the risks that they are taking. And to the extent that they are dedicating the money of shareholders or private investors, that they can assure them that they are doing so in a responsible fashion, that if it does pay off, that they are going to get a reasonable market return. I think, you know, Leslie addressed the notion that universities are engaged in very, very meaningful research, oftentimes very well supported by our federal money, but that it's very early in the pipeline. And universities are great at inventing groundbreaking technologies and making early discoveries. But I think what oftentimes the man on the street might not appreciate is what it takes to go from that one molecule or that one molecular pathway that might have been discovered in a university lab to turn that into something that is actually safe, effective, and efficacious to put into the human body and will actually fight off a disease. And that process alone often takes billions of dollars and up to 10 years in research. That is not the kind of research that universities do well. Universities do the type of groundbreaking early on fundamental research that might lead to something that can then be further investigated, but that's more in the lines of product development. And that's what usually private investment, private companies or publicly traded companies might get into. And they're more suited to take the risk and to invest in the resources that are needed to go down that long development of path or that long development pathway. So if we don't have the ability to provide the sort of exclusivity, if you will, that comes with a patent, so that the, I would say, downstream investors can expect that they will get a reasonable return on their investment, they're just not going to come to the table and they're not going to engage in that kind of research. So there is, I think, very well established evidence that shows that prior to Bayh-Dole, virtually none of the molecules that had been invented in university labs had been developed into pharmaceutical products. And subsequent to Bayh-Dole, the number of products that have come out of universities and been developed by private industry into safe and effective pharmaceuticals numbers in the hundreds. So Bayh-Dole has opened a tremendous and valuable doorway for this sort of collaboration to take place between universities and between the private sector. But I think as Corey further mentioned, you know, those sorts of collaborations don't just take place between foundational research at universities and downstream developers. It takes place within the industry. And so the ability of certain companies to get into and out of industries and markets that they are interested in is also paved by the patent system. So Corey mentioned the fact that they have sold off their vaccine unit to another entity. Well, they wouldn't have been able to do that, but for the fact that they had patents around those resources and those assets, and they conveyed those assets to the purchaser. And so perhaps there was some consolidation of expertise there that allowed the purchaser to do a much better job of developing those products into useful vaccines for our respective health and well-being. So I think that the patent system plays a very important part in terms of early research and facilitating the development of downstream products that improve all of our quality of life.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you to all our panelists for a fantastic description of not just the initial research that's being done at universities and the upstream research, but the incredible role that patents serve as a platform for both funding that research, but even more importantly, funding the downstream development and making it possible for there to be existing commercial and technological infrastructure to that has given us an incredible jump start on this pandemic, that this pandemic, no matter how bad it ends up being, will not be a repeat of the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. And now I heard many of you describe in incredible detail in both kind of legal and commercial terms how patents facilitate innovation. And this seems to go against what most people think of as patents as simply kind of incentivizing the initial act of development and discovery, that you've instead described facilitation of innovation through the creation of both commercial and other structures, like licensing through the Bayh-Dole Act through universities, that then results in having that invention being deployed as an actual innovation in the healthcare market. Is there anything more to expand on this point a bit further? Once we address that question, I'll turn it over to Nathan to give instructions to everyone to queue up. And while they're doing that, I'll ask one more question. So anyone on the panelists want to kind of expand a bit more on some of these great points you've made?
This is
I'm
Leslie.
Happy to start, Adam. Leslie,
okay.
Go ahead first.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, what I'd add to that is this, and I think I don't want this to get lost in the discussion either, is that the university's prime purpose is actually research, teaching, and service. And our ultimate aim is to get knowledge out for the public good, either through graduating students, publications, knowledge sharing, and the like. And so when we are fulfilling our obligations through the Bayh-Dole Act by looking at inventions that are disclosed to the respective tech transfer offices or whatever they're called at various universities, we're looking at these with an eye to how do we get to get a publication as quickly as possible, but at the same time protect something that might be there for somebody else at some point in the future, whether it's tomorrow, unlikely because it's so early stage, or a year down the road. And it's the patent system that lets us do that. And there are many, many things that are not patented at universities. There is open source software, there's tangible property, there's all sorts of materials that go out and are shared between partners and the like. But our obligation is actually to make sure that students graduate, that faculty are doing fundamental research, having global impact, and to have a global impact and to do the publication side of things, we need something in between, something that protects rights, that will attract other parties who are going to invest millions more dollars, you know, 100x of what's been invested on the research side in order to facilitate whether or not this is a product or a service that could be sustained or developed in the marketplace. And so it's useful just to put in context where the new ideas are coming from and what other obligations we have, and if not for the system that we have, it would be very hard for us to fulfill our primary mission.
So I would just add that, Adam, on part of your question was about most people thinking about patents as promoting the initial act of invention only. And my answer to that is people need to start thinking more about innovation as a process and not a product. And I think that's unfortunately a common misconception, that when you think of an innovation as something that embodies an innovation and there it is. But really, particularly in our field, as Brian mentioned, I mean, it takes 10 to 15 years on average to invent and develop a new drug. And that substance, that active substance that people think of as the medicine, is usually invented and patented very early on in that period. After that, it takes an extraordinary amount of investment. It's in the billions of dollars on average per product to take that active substance and actually bring it to the point where it's approved as a safe and effective medicine. And that includes things like finding the right form of the substance, even once you have a starting point, formulating it with the right ingredients, finding the right way to get it into the body. Should it be oral or topical or intravenous? Should it be a capsule or a tablet? What's the dosaging? And each of these different pre-launch innovations is a separate part of the development process, the D in the R&D. It's a separate invention in many cases, and it may be patentable in many cases if it meets the criteria for patentability. And it's really worth noting, and this is connected to the whole Bayh-Dole point, which is incredibly important, the Bayh-Dole discussion and the equally important but very different roles that universities versus the private sector play. Once we start the clinical studies, which is, you know, when we're testing in animals and then and then into humans, and of course is critical to drug approval and getting safe and effective medicines. Even once we start those studies, only 12% of drug candidates will actually succeed at the end of the day. So flip that around, 88% of those fail. And that is also where the bulk of the investment is and the bulk, of course, of that kind of risk. So the Bayh-Dole Act, of course, through you know, allowing the patents to be for title to go to the universities or the contractor that's funded, and then to license it off in those cases where it is initially, you know, some of the basic research or the initial compound in some cases is discovered by the university, without the ability to transfer the patent rights and license them. All of that, the bulk of the investment and the bulk of the risk, again, looking at that 12% number, wouldn't happen without the Bayh-Dole Act and the mechanics there. And it is largely why the United States has emerged, you know, since Bayh-Dole as really the world leader in innovation and in producing. There are a couple other countries as well. I mean, we're a Swiss company, although our major R&D headquarters is based in the U.S. in Cambridge, Mass. So we, of course, are very, very much fully invested on the R&D side in the U.S. too, but it's countries that have the robust patent systems, and then Bayh-Dole adds to that, and that's why largely explains why, you know, most of these innovations are coming out of countries with those systems in place.
Yeah, and I would add too that you know, I think Leslie's point is a very good one. Universities are in the business of providing education, research, and getting it out there for the public good. A lot of that is facilitated through the patent system and particularly the Bayh-Dole system through sponsored research. A lot of what goes into educating our graduate students and doing this fundamental research is, in fact, funded by private enterprise companies like Cory's that come in and collaborate with universities and basically fund a lot of the research. Well, a lot of that funding actually makes it possible for graduate students to do their studies and to finish their research and then to go out into industry and to, you know, continue to develop. And if it weren't for the patent system and the Bayh-Dole system in particular, it wouldn't be prudent or responsible for private sector companies to give their money to universities knowing that any developments that came out of it weren't protected or couldn't efficiently be developed into downstream products. And I would also add to Corey's comments about innovation as a process. I couldn't agree more with that. You know, we've heard from a lot of different sources that there will be not just one solution to COVID, but there will be many solutions to COVID. And more importantly, they will be developed through particular expertise of many distinct entities working together. And when you're working together, the best way that you can work together is through a systematic approach that ensures that those who are participating in that process are actually going to get a good return on their investment. And that's what the patent system and the Bayh-Dole system does, is it allows people to effectively track what their respective contributions are and to ensure that they'll get some kind of a return on that investment and that contribution.
If I could just add one more point to build on what Brian just said, because it's an incredibly important point. You know, in addition to the process of innovation leading up to the launch of a drug, as Brian just mentioned in the COVID context as one example, you also need to continue to have incentives to keep improving drugs even once they're on the market. And that's in part why it wasn't aimed only at pharmaceuticals, but why improvements have been part of the U.S. patent system since 1790, right? I mean, it's in the Patent Act and always has been that improvements are patentable. And as Brian said, in the COVID situation, not only does IP facilitate repurposing existing drugs for COVID, drugs originally approved for other things, as I gave some examples of in the opening, but as Brian also mentioned, even after we have some treatments here for COVID, it is very unlikely, unfortunately, that the first treatments are going to be the silver bullets that we're looking for. And all you need to do is look at the news for that, right? I mean, remdesivir, which is one of the only products that's currently approved anywhere for COVID, it's great that we have something, but as we all know, I mean, it looks like it's allowing patients to get out of the hospital 3 or 4 days quicker. It's not preventing the infection. It's not stopping it. It's not the drug that we're all hoping for. So we're going to need the IP to continue to improve on this first wave of treatments. A vaccine is unlikely, once we have one, to be unlikely to be a one-time shot. It may need to be annual, in which case you're going to need incentives for people to keep making it and to keep making it better year after year. The COVID virus may end up mutating, this particular COVID virus, but also new coronaviruses may cause new pandemics in the future. So we'll need those incentives to continue to be prepared for those. So there's lots of examples of why IP as an incentive is needed, because, again, going back to the main point, innovation is not an end product. It's a process, and we need to keep innovating if we're going to stay ahead of viruses like this one and pandemics for the future.
Excellent. Excuse me. Excellent. If you were all my students, you would all get A's in responses to that initial question. Nathan, will you describe for our audience how they can queue up and ask some questions if they have any?
Yeah. Thank you, Adam, and thank you to everyone for your thoughts.
Nathan, has anyone queued up yet?
Yes. Looks like we have one question in, so we can go to that one now if you're ready.
Well, and I would just like to reiterate Nathan's point as well, that please ask a question. So we prefer that any statements end with the grammatical mark of a question mark at the end. So with that, please open up the floor.
Yes, very good. We'll go to our first question now.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Alfonso Chan in Dallas, Texas. I'm a patent lawyer here. And I'd like to ask a question about your views on the IPR process and its effect on university-owned patents, and whether that's a positive or a negative effect or somewhere in between.
Okay, so shall I take the first shot at this piece?
Sounds appropriate.
So I guess when the IPR process first came in, which now seems like many, many years ago, I mean, our biggest concern, and at the time I was at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, was that the security of the patent system was being completely undermined, that we would have people unwilling to invest, again, in the early stage research licensing that we were doing, because there was going to be even more uncertainty about whether or not our patents would prevail, given how the IPR system was set up. I'm not sure now that we're actually seeing that, but there is always in the back of my mind. I mean, we quite frankly, when you have strong patents, you kind of expect them to be litigated and challenged, and you try and build a patent portfolio that will encourage investment and allow people to protect the appropriate rights, and that's the way that certainly MIT does it. It does not want to aggressively enforce, but it will protect its rights if it's challenged. So I don't know that anybody, and certainly any of my colleagues who might be on the call might want to pipe up, is I don't know it's actually changed our practices with the way in which we do business, but it certainly gave us pause about how it was going to impact our ability to license and have other people invest in the technology as is required for us to actually get technologies into the marketplace.
I could just add, I mean, generally, I rather than speaking about university patents, I just think in general, IPR in concept, I think is fine and arguably an important mechanism as it was originally designed as an alternative to litigation and a more efficient and more cost-effective way for challenging patents. And I think as long as it plays that role, it's something that's important to have. I think where you run into issues in our industry for biopharmaceuticals is where it has unfortunately been used in many cases, not as an alternative to litigation, but as a second bite at the apple, where we've seen cases, even our own company, of challengers making the exact same arguments on the exact same prior art twice, you know, first in court and then in IPR. I think the patent office has come a very long way to it's not perfect, but they've improved the process quite a bit and have really made some positive changes to make it restore it a little bit more to what it was intended to do. But like anything, you know, it has the potential to be abused. So as long as it's kind of honed in and used for the right purposes, I think it has its place.
Yeah, I would agree with what Corey just said. I think that's a very good summary. I think it started from a place of good intention, but as often legislation does, the implementation has turned out to be less than ideal and filled with unintended consequences. And so, you know, we have a lot of people that are playing games. We have what I consider to be something of a constitutional conflict between what decision is rendered by an Article III judge versus what decision is rendered by an administrative tribunal at the patent office. But I also agree with Corey that PTO Director Iancu has done a remarkable job of tidying things up. I think he's put the perspectives and the priorities in a much better place than where they were initially. But I do believe that we still have a long way to go to fix that process. There is just way too much gamesmanship going on, and the strength and reliability of a U.S. patent just isn't what it used to be. And that's bad for innovation, because people are then much less inclined to invest in innovation, and we lose that sort of competitive edge that we have of being the most innovative economy in the world. So I think to the extent we can modify the system and get back into one where the U.S. patent is, in fact, reliable, dependable asset, we'll be doing ourselves a big, big favor. I'll leave it at that.
Excellent. Nathan, is there anyone else in the queue?
Yep. Looks like we've got another questioner, so we will go to that individual now.
All right.
Hello, my name is Bill Barrett. I'm a patent attorney in Indianapolis. I would like someone to comment on the opening lines in the synopsis for today about how activists and politicians are critical of the patent system in this particular area. And perhaps could someone discuss the legal issues that companies and universities will be facing concerning march-in rights and, you might say, eminent domain to get these drugs out?
Sure. So I'm happy to start on that one. Yes, unfortunately, we have seen, you know, one of the first kind of knee-jerk reactions to the pandemic from some was to kind of, you know, throw out the whole system that is that, you know, we in the field, of course, know is what fuels the development and the invention of vaccines and medicines. And we've seen this mostly outside the U.S., thankfully, so far. Many countries, not many, I should say, let me take that back. I mean, a handful of countries have passed new legislation that would impose automatic compulsory licensing on anything that's useful in treating COVID-19. Others have simply, you know, more kind of just adjusted their laws a little bit to make it easier to get a compulsory license on a case-by-case basis if and when needed. And still others have gotten together through the World Health Organization and the multilateral organizations in Geneva and have called for what they're saying are voluntary pooling mechanisms for not just patents, but also know-how and regulatory data and all the other tools that are needed to create new medicines and vaccines. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of this is being driven by anti-IP activism and by those groups that have been against the patent system long before there was a pandemic, are simply using, you know, this as a reason to advance those ideological ideas and goals. And I think, you know, in the U.S., we do need to guard against it because the march-in rights situation is one that even before the pandemic, because of the debate over drug pricing, has become one of those proposals that some have been looking for to address, you know, some of the issues with the complex issue of drug pricing. And, you know, what's unfortunate, of course, as we talked about throughout this panel, is that in the first place, I mean, let's focus on COVID for now. We, of course, need treatments and vaccines in the first place to have access. And if you take away the IP, you know, especially if you do it across the board, it only reduces the incentives to invest in innovation around COVID And perhaps more importantly, though, as one of the points I always try to make is, you probably can successfully, you know, walk in and take away everything that we have today by getting rid of IP and giving it to everyone else, and then you'll get immediate, in some cases, and not all, and I'll explain that in a minute, but you may get, in some situations, quote unquote, improved access because you've taken it all and redistributed it. But what you will do at the same time is virtually ensure that there'll be nobody investing in cures or treatments for the next pandemic or for any other areas where this looks like a threat. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is, you know, as a factual matter, here, the industry has stepped up, and as I mentioned at the beginning, there's an unprecedented level of collaboration and innovation going on without any of these mechanisms in place. We don't need things like voluntary patent pools, even if you're going to call them voluntary, to get entities, public and private, private and university, private to private together. This is already happening at grand scale. And in terms of access, the other point, and this is why I caveated what I said before, even if you were to take away all the IP today, I don't believe that you would actually, in all cases, get improved access even to the treatments that already exist. And the reason why is because IP is not just a tool for incentivizing innovation, but it's also a tool that helps improve and facilitate direct access to medicine, because it's innovators driven by the IP incentive that had the capacity and the know-how and the ability to not only scale up and manufacture and control the quality of their medicines, but to actually get it distributed successfully all over the world. We're the ones that invest in distribution chains to get, you know, medicines to rural areas in developing countries. We're the ones that both abroad and in the United States invest a lot of money in, you know, in developing the market by educating doctors and patients about the existence of a drug, how it's used properly, and improving patient compliance. And in this case, for COVID, most innovators, everyone in the industry that I know, all the other companies, including Novartis, have pledged to make any medicines that we make for COVID available, you know, and to have equitable access to it. We haven't always defined exactly what that means yet, because it's going to depend on the case by case, of course. But there's voluntary licensing going on. There's product donations going on. There's compassionate use programs that have been established. You know, we're working with lawmakers to make sure the pricing is right. And at the same time, you know, IP, of course, helps to prevent counterfeiting and subpar products from getting on the market in some of these situations. And counterfeiting has been a huge problem already, not just for medicines, but for PPE as well. So I think all of these, you know, the point is all of these are incredibly bad ideas, not only because they would undermine innovation, but they would actually hurt the direct access piece of getting, you know, fast and broad access to COVID treatments as quickly as possible, to as many as possible. So thanks for the question, but those are my views.
Yeah, this is Brian. I can't add too much to what Corey said, because you've done such a wonderful job of answering it so comprehensively. But I would say, and not to make it seem too simplistic, but it is a classic example of teach someone to fish and you know, give a man a fish and he eats today, teach a man how to fish and he eats for a lifetime. You know, yeah, we could institute compulsory licensing and make all the drugs that are available today readily available to others to get out to the population. But there, as Corey says, there won't be that next generation of drugs to deal with the next pandemic. And I think history has shown very effectively that where there are jurisdictions that facilitate compulsory licensing, they tend to be very poor innovators. They are not innovation-oriented economies. They are economies that are taking advantage of the innovation that takes place elsewhere. And we have seen that in a number of instances. I think one of the successes of the 90s initiative of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was that we got a number of countries who had very, very weak IP systems to sign on to a more rigorous regime. And what has happened in each one of those countries? They have gone from having very, very little innovation and technology in their economy to now being very robust innovators and robust technology-based economies. And it's because they instituted a rigorous patent system, oftentimes to political resistance, but nonetheless, they did it and they've reaped the benefits.
Maybe I'll just add really briefly, Brian, you mentioned this before, but the statistic that I know is that before the Bayh-Dole Act in, you know, in 1980, less than 5% of government-funded research was commercialized or taken up at all by the private sector. And as you mentioned, that number has dramatically changed since Bayh-Dole. And that gives you a good historical glimpse of what would happen if you started exercising margin rights on a regular basis, because, you know, the private sector, not just for the biopharma industry, but for all industries, because Bayh-Dole is technology neutral, the private sector would not be investing in applied science and developing government-funded research into practical products that we all enjoy and need.
I don't have anything to add. The gentleman covered it all.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. No point using up the airwaves.
She just incorporates by references all of your prior comments. So
thank you very much.
So, Nathan, is there anyone else in the queue?
There is one more. I think that if we have time for it, I know we're coming up on the hour, but if you're willing to answer, stick around for one more. We can go to the next one.
Hi, this is Tyson Benson from Detroit, Michigan, a patent attorney up in this area. As it sounds like, we need to probably educate our legislatures on the Congress people and so forth on the importance of the patent system. How would you recommend going about educating them on the importance? Because as you probably recognize, the other side has, or the anti-intellectual property side has continued to go about and put forth some a narrative that as you talked about before, with drug prices and just general IP issues. So I'll take it off your answer off air. Thank you.
Well, this is Leslie. I think, one, it's already happening, and I think it's a full-time job in perpetuity. Myself and others, Brian and others, have been up to the hill and talked in front of staffers and individuals who basically hopefully have the ear of the Congress and others. It is an ongoing dialogue to demonstrate the necessity for a strong patent system and also investment in university research. And I think the Endless Frontier Act that has been recently proposed is an example of the recognition of that need. But it is truly a community effort to talk about all of the various aspects of innovation, of not just university innovation or startups or venture capitalists, or it's every single part that is actually going to try to get the U.S. back to its dominant position as an innovation society.
So I guess I would add that, I think the way to do it, that's exactly right. And many of my peers as well on the private sector side have also been, regularly up on the Hill and testifying in some cases live, and publicly about some of the issues that we need to strengthen our IP system. But I think the substantive answer in a way is that we need to first of all, get to a place again where we're putting policy ahead of ideology. And that's not always the case in today's world, all over the world, right? And we do have ideological bases sometimes for, unfortunately, that are shaping policy instead of facts and data. So I think we need to get back to evidence and data instead of just blind ideology. And I think the other piece for me is to make sure that we're getting the right speakers and the right voices. I don't mean on the individual level, but more on the entity level. So it's one thing for industry to make its case, but of course, by definition, because we're the ones that are directly impacted, some people view us with some bias. So I think in addition to our voices, we need to have the universities and even the NIH, come forward and I know there's some that are already going on. Leslie's done a great job today, for example, talking about the critical role that the universities play, but also explaining the very different role that universities play vis-a-vis the industry. And the NIH will tell you the same thing when you talk to them. So I think it's really important to have that kind of coalition of voices that are all, saying the same thing, which reflects, at least in my view, the truth based on the evidence and the facts.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And again, to Leslie's point, we do spend some time up on the Hill. We spend some time on behalf of the Licensing Executive Society. advocating for strong IP. The Licensing Executive Society is dedicated to strong IP, and LES is a professional society that represents every technology sector. It's not just pharma, it's not just high tech. And we spend a good deal of time trying to educate legislators and the staff about the importance of IP and the importance of licensing of IP in terms of stimulating our economy and promoting innovation. I think as the question contemplates, unfortunately, we are a little bit outgunned. There are a number of large enterprises out there that believe in practicing efficient infringement. And that means basically I'm going to steal your idea until a court tells me that I can't. That, of course, is tantamount to theft. And so it's not something that I think most Americans subscribe to. But nonetheless, at least one commentator has urged that some companies have a fiduciary duty, if you will, to their shareholders to do that. That, I think, is beyond the pale. But nonetheless, that is the position some people have taken. So there are lots of people who believe that eliminating the IP system would be to their advantage, and to the extent it allows others to take the assets of inventors, maybe they're right, but it's not exactly the most ethical approach, and I think it's just contrary to the basic American mindset of, you know, supporting the intrepid inventor who's out there trying to make the world a better place, and I think we should do everything we can to support that spirit and that mindset.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note to end our excellent panel discussion on this topic. I believe that all three of you have just done a fantastic job explaining that, you know, in response to the question, are patents a boost or a barrier, right, or a facilitator or a blockade? They are a facilitator. They are a booster. They are a platform for an ongoing process of not just technological innovation, but commercial innovation as well, as products and services are invented in the university lab or in someone's garage, and then are bridged from that initial invention into real-world innovation, real-world technological products and services, real-world medical care for patients through the various mechanisms that all of you have described. So thank you. Thank you for taking your time out of your very busy schedules to talk about these very important issues and contribute to evidence-based policymaking, evidence-based policy discussions about these very important issues. And hopefully we have people on this call who are policymakers or work for policymakers and are hearing about the very important issues that you raised and the data and the evidence, and we'll be taking that with them. So on behalf of everyone on this call, I know that we are very appreciative of this. So thank you, Leslie. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Brian. Nathan?
Yeah, just to echo what Adam said, thank you to each of you for a really excellent discussion. We're grateful for your time and expertise. We welcome any listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. Have a great day.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. Catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.